This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Well, I almost want to say thank you very much for inviting me to come before this audience and undertake a virtually impossible task of summarizing in 5 minutes the ultimate solution to the issue of of the modern Muslim world. What I'd like to do, I think, though, however, is try to at least sort of contextualize or frame what I anticipate to be the debate itself, such that my comments that may emerge during the question and answer period may actually take on the meaning that are the meanings that are intended by them. I want to start off by saying the following. I think that when we come to the question of Islam and liberal democracy, I think we have to be very careful about distinguishing between Islam on the one hand as a religion and the Arab Middle East on the other hand. I think there is a tendency often to conflate the two and to imagine that whatever possibilities may seem feasible out of the Arab Middle East, then they are the equivalent of the possibilities of Islam. Whereas in point of fact, if other traditionally Muslim communities were contemplated as the focal point of the discussion, we may come out with a very different set of possibilities. Beyond that, I also want to speak in my own capacity as a Western convert to Islam. And I say that only to say the following, and that is that part of what I see as being the problem of discussing the whole topic of Islam and democracy is that there is this presumption that every single aspect of Islam has always been dictated by Scripture. Whereas in point of fact, Scripture has not simply served as a dictator of institutions, but rather as a filter through which pre-existing institutions, pre-existing values, pre-existing ideas and ways of doing things are either accepted or rejected, i.e. they are assessed. And therefore, coming to Islam from a Western background, for whom democratic sensibilities in general come very naturally, the segue into a discussion about democracy for me may be very different for someone who comes from a different background. And I think we need to be very careful about which background we give priority to in terms of what we consider to be a normative discussion of the issue of Islam and democracy. So there is a very real sense in which we need to recognize that articulations of Islam are and have been throughout the history of Islam variegated and multiple. And the histories of Muslim communities are also variegated and multiple. And I think we have to be very careful about which of these articulations and which of these histories we're using as a template when we come to discussion of Islam and democracy. Now, having said that much, I mean, my own personal sense is that there is a growing and potentially irreversible sort of tacit consensus emerging in various parts of the Muslim world with regard to the overall desirability and the permissibility, I shouldn't say permissibility, but the extent, the compatibility between the broad parameters and outlines of Islam and democracy. I think the big question arises when we add that adjective, liberal democracy, because I think that there again, there's a tendency to conflate democracy with liberal democracy. Democracy itself, I don't think you'll find very many Muslim communities today who are not insistent upon a greater accountability on the part of those who happen to wield power in society. Liberal democracy, however, brings along with it other kinds of instrumentalities that may, or at least are perceived to, pose certain problems for religious discourse. I mean, and Muslims aren't the only ones who feel this. I mean, we can talk about people like McIntyre and any other number of communitarians and others who have certain misgivings about the relationship between liberalism and certain communitarian modalities of collective being. So I think that we need to distinguish between democracy on the one hand and liberal democracy on the other. The third point that I want to make, and there are only four, is that we need to, and I think that Professor Naeem alluded to this at least in part, although I'm not sure we mean this in the very same way, but the notion that Islamic law is static and unchanging, on the one hand, and on the other hand, that secular processes of reasoning, of assessing reality, of assessing interests and harms, is some kind of newfangled aspect that is being superimposed on Islamic discourse from without. That is not the case. It has always been the case that while scripture has been the database upon which Muslims have attempted to contemplate their transcendent meanings and how they are to be translated into a lived reality, that very process has always been mediated by secular forms of reason. Indeed, there is no Quranic reason, per se. And this is very clear in all of the variations that you get in Islamic law. It's clear in all of the variety you get in Muslim theology. Secular modalities of reasoning have always come in competition one with the other in the context of contemplating the meaning of Islam on the ground. Related to this is the fact that there are any number of aspects of life that have always been part of the realm of sort of discretionary assessment. And just to make a very long story short and try and keep within my time, while Islamic law, for example, may establish as a value the physical health and well-being of all individuals, Islamic law per se has very little to say about healthcare as a policy issue. That issue would have to be debated out. It would have to be assessed on the merits. It would have to be calibrated according to certain principles and parameters of Islamic law. But the Quran does not have any dictate with regard to whether our healthcare plan should or should not have a public option. All of those issues would have to be debated. And this is the way that it's always been. I think if we look at the state of Arabian society upon the death of the Prophet Muhammad, and then just a couple of centuries later, we look at just the table of contents of the standard manuals of Islamic law, we will find all kinds of added institutions that were not around at the time of the Prophet that are added to the edifice of Islamic law as staple issues upon which legal contemplation should proceed. And there is no reason why that should have to stop. Take, for example, again, Dr. Naeem talked about the caliphate of Abu Bakr and Uthman and Ali, etc. At the time of those four caliphs, and they are after the Prophet Muhammad, there was no such institution as the Sultanate. The Sultanate didn't come about for another 400 years or so. And yet the Sultanate emerges as a sort of semi-permanent institution in Islam throughout the pre-modern period. My point being here is that Islamic law, Islamic religious contemplation has always been open to evolutionary development. And finally, I just want to say this, that one of the things that concerns me about the manner in which this whole discussion about the relationship between Islam and democracy proceeds is that, to my mind at least, it sort of assumes the sort of Francis Fukuyama thesis about the end of history, and therefore there is nothing to contemplate beyond liberal democracy as a modality of political organization for modern communities. I would like to challenge us to do two things, to be a bit more imaginative and to imagine that there might be ways in which we may be actually able to improve on a political organization on the one hand, and then to imagine what Islam might have to contribute to that very possibility. And I think that one of the stepstones to that potential realization would be not simply to look at all that liberal democracy has achieved, but rather take a more honest and objective look at some of the failings of liberal democracy. Thank you very much.